Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. As you may remember, last July, a peaceful protest in Dallas after the police shooting deaths of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling was rocked by gunfire. A former Army reservist targeted and gunned down several officers escorting protesters. When the dust started to settle after the attack, Dallas Police Chief David O. Brown addressed the city and the nation.
We're asking cops to do too much in this country. We are. We're just asking us to do too much. Every societal failure, we put it off on the cops to solve. Not enough mental health funding. Let the cop handle it. Not enough drug addiction funding. Let's give it to the cops. Here in Dallas, we got a loose dog problem. Let's have the cops chase loose dogs. Schools fail. Give it to the cops. 70% of the African American community is being raised by single women. Let's give it to the cops to solve that as well. That's too much to ask. Policing was never meant to solve all those problems.
Chief Brown's response to the Dallas shootings moved the country and highlighted the challenges of urban policing and other social policy. The question now is, have we heard him? That's a question many may be asking even more in the wake of yesterday's mass shooting that left Congressman Steve Scalise in critical condition and others injured, and the one at a UPS facility in San Francisco. Brown has since retired as police chief, and he has now written a book, Called to Rise, A Life in Faithful Service to the Community That Made Me. He's here with me now to talk about that fateful day, the news of today, and his background and belief in community policing. Welcome to WNYC, Chief Brown. Thank you very much for coming on with us.
Thank you very much, Brian, for having me.
How much do you feel, first of all, that you were heard in those 45 seconds that we replayed that got so much attention at the time, and has anything changed?
I'm always hopeful that people hear what you're saying in crisis moments, how long it lasts or sustains itself in the fast-changing news cycles that we find ourselves in, oftentimes caught up in just the sensational news of the day, is the big question for me. I'm not sure, but I think there continues to be hope for policing and communities and for our country.
I think one of the things that the Dallas shooting has in common with yesterday's in Virginia is that it had political overtones. The police officers targeted in Dallas were targeted because they were police officers and white police officers at that. The Republican congressmen were targeted because they were Republican congressmen. And so critics like New York Republican Congressman Chris Collins yesterday, one of Donald Trump's biggest supporters, say the hot political rhetoric causes this and needs to be toned down. People said that about Black Lives Matter after the Dallas shooting, even though the protest that day was overwhelmingly peaceful, you know, except for the lone gunman. How much is that your position? How much is that the right conversation or the wrong conversation to have, in your opinion?
It's, in my opinion, it's, you know, pretty much a human nature reaction, knee-jerk, when you have something like that happen, another shooting that, you know, has become our new normal, another shooting, and we have many others that doesn't get the same coverage because it's just another shooting. So I'm not so sure that the comments on the same day that it happens often can really fully describe some of the really very complex issues that are related to gun violence as it relates to, I'd like to know what this suspect's motivations were. Is there any mental illness or drug addiction or prior criminal behavior associated with his political rhetoric, relationships with friends and family? I need to have a deeper dive into this suspect to really pull out what this means in the conversation around our politics.
And very possibly this was another mentally ill individual, and
yes,
people's mental illness attaches to whatever is salient to them. And sometimes it's personal, sometimes it's employment related, sometimes it's political, or other things. The Dallas shooter, Micah Johnson, who gunned down the officers, was considered probably mentally ill. And you write,
yes,
in your book, and I'm queasy even asking you to talk about it, but you did write about it in your book, so I guess you mm-hmm. want to, your
yes.
own traumatic experiences dealing with mental health issues and police in your family. What would you like to say?
My son suffered from adult onset bipolar disease, often, and the bipolar has many facets, so everyone with bipolar don't have violent tendencies, but some do, particularly untreated. And my son was untreated, undiagnosed. We find this out after the fact, particularly when you're an adult. Sometimes family don't get that information from doctors. And really the takeaway from yesterday's events with this shooter is likely mental health undertones. My son was killed after killing two people, one a police officer in a suburban city here in Dallas, as a result of his mental illness and self-medicating with drugs, on street drugs. There's no funding. There's no legitimate policy for broad mental health treatment. It's embarrassing. Still today, a mentally ill person diagnosed can still purchase a gun in this country in many states. And that's really the scourge of many of these active shooter incidents in our country that's happening, that we never peel back layers of the causes and get to really what really is an underfunded mental health and drug treatment population in our country. And we can't, particularly with the rising opioid crisis, we can't seem to find a way to find compromise in policy and funding.
My guest is former Dallas Police Chief David Brown. His new book is called To Rise, A Life in Faithful Service to the Community That Made Me. And we can take your phone calls for Chief Brown at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Have you noticed that another association with the mass shooters, once their biographies become known, is that there's often a history of domestic violence? It seems to be the case again with this
yes.
Virginia shooter, the person who, until the Dallas incident, was probably the best-known police assassin in recent times, the guy who shot the police officers in New York City a few Decembers ago. He shot his girlfriend that same day in Baltimore and then came to New York and shot those two officers. Have you noticed that association and have any thought about it?
Yes, not only have I noticed, our scholarly researchers in this country have noticed. There's much research written about the intersections of domestic violence, mental health, drug addiction, and extreme violence, active shooter. So I think that's where we need to really find more research around gun violence, which we don't fund. Again, this is my biggest frustration. We need to do more research so we can peel back the layers and actually have some solutions. You can't arrest your way out of mental health, poor mental health policies. You can't arrest your way out of underfunded drug treatment in this country. You can't arrest your way out of domestic violence issues when you don't find the guts to find compromise around these very, very complex policies that we just can't find a way to find any kind of agreement on.
On that complexity, we seemed to be heading in one direction in this country regarding criminal justice before the election, and that's being not just slowed but reversed by President Trump and Attorney General Jeff Sessions. We were headed toward rethinking mass incarceration, especially the arrest and imprisonment of so many young men of color for low-level nonviolent drug offenses. Now Sessions is explicitly reversing course at the federal level, citing the rising murder rate in some cities as a reason. In your experience in law enforcement, is this necessary to the general public safety?
In my book, I refer to this quite candidly, this is how I started out where AG Sessions is when I started in law enforcement in 1983. I wanted to put them all in jail, let God sort them out. Every crime victim feels this way. When someone breaks into your house or violently kills or seriously injures a loved one, you want the person that did it put in jail. But the reality is what happens when you go down this road is, I learned this over 33 years, we have a math problem when it comes to mass incarceration. We don't have enough jail bed space nor the funding to continue to grow our prison populations to make it something that's reasonable. And the math problem is, you know, we arrest many more people than we can hold in jail, and so it's a revolving door. Every criminal you put in jail, two or three gets released, and it's laid in the lap of police officers to be in this revolving criminal justice system without any hopes of reform in any kind of significant way, because we, you know, play this political football game with these ideas when there is a stark reality and a practicality to this. So you just can't arrest your way out of crime to make us safer. Actually, when we were mass incarcerating people at the highest levels in the 80s and 90s, the crime rates were the highest in this country. Because I was on the streets and I was looking at it and I was dealing with it and being shot at and having to chase the same crooks till they got too old to run from us. Hmm. So it's just not a practical thing. But I see how he's there starting out that, you know, well, I'm the crime victim and I want somebody put in jail. And it's just the reality is downstream that it just doesn't make us safer because we have a revolving door of criminals coming in and out of the criminal justice system.
Was that why you wanted to be a police officer in the first place, because of the scourge of drug violence in your own neighborhood?
Yes. At the advent of the crack cocaine epidemic caused me to leave the college I was attending my senior year and put in an application and become a police officer. It's the reason why I went into policing, is to protect my old neighborhood. That was my first beat. And I found through experience that community policing makes us all safer, the cops and citizens, that the people who put skin in the game in the community and help us resolve some of the crime problems in their community and be willing to participate more in the democratic process at the local level is our solution. It's how our system was set up. Reform comes from more participation in the local elections there in your cities and counties.
What was that neighborhood you grew up in, and how's it now?
Oak Cliff, it's much better than it was in the 80s. We still struggle. It's a poor neighborhood. I grew up poor. I never forgot where I've come from, and I always had an affinity for poor, impoverished neighborhoods and the young people, particularly young people of color, who struggle to find a way out, and I you know, want to be that example for them and you know, try to provide some safety, but get them involved in the solutions rather than just identifying the problems and putting it at the feet of the police to resolve, because that's just not a solution. Policing was never meant to solve some of our, very complex, entrenched societal failures.
Did you, as a young black man considering a career in law enforcement, have ambivalence given the role or perception of the police vis-a-vis black America?
My old man did. My father did. He discouraged me from doing it. He didn't get treated well, being born in 1940 and living through the Jim Crow South and segregated, separate but equal. He didn't see policing as a good profession to be in, and he discouraged me. But I was insistent on doing something. I just couldn't stand by and watch the crack cocaine epidemic destroy my old neighborhood and not do anything about it but complain and be frustrated. I wanted to do something about it. I wanted to be part of the solution, and I put 33 years in as a cop, and I'm proud of it. I'm proud of the fact that I made my neighborhood safer.
We'll continue in a minute with your phone calls for former Dallas Police Chief David Brown, his new book called To Rise, a Life in Faithful Service to the Community That Made Me. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with retired Dallas Police Chief David Brown. His new book is called To Rise. And I misplaced your book here. There it is. It's called Called to Rise, Dallas Police Chief, retired David Brown. And there you go. And David in Westchester, you're on WNYC with Chief Brown. Hi, David.
Hi. I have a question related to some of the bad publicity that the police have gotten, on the other hand, which is often attributed to having bad apples in the force. And I was wondering if Chief Brown could comment on his experience coming up through the force over the years. He clearly must have seen bad apples who were not sort of ushered out of the police force. And then as police chief, what was he able to do about that? And was there an effective program, or did he run into resistance in trying to do that?
Thank you, David.
Good question. I fired over 60 officers during my tenure, and I bumped heads with the police culture, protected by the police union bosses, which are very strong. Some are pretty good, actually, in advocating for paying benefits, but others advocate to keep the culture the same. And, you put your career on the line trying to clean house with the 1 or 2% that shouldn't be a police officer. So they can hijack the organization, hijack the profession when you don't deal with them appropriately and get them out of law enforcement. But the 98-99% of cops, some of the bravest, most courageous people you ever want to see, they risk their lives for you. The July 7th incident is an example of police officers running to our bullets here in Dallas, protecting people who were protesting by providing a shield for them with their bodies, and ultimately making the sacrifice of giving their life. Five officers gave their lives for protecting the citizens of Dallas. And they're the guardians of this democracy here in our borders. So, you know, we just can't let the 1 or 2% and paint with a broad brush the profession. And I appreciate you making a distinction that there is a group that's not the majority that paint us all with a bad brush.
So you're saying 1 or 2%, but you're also saying police culture. You just used that term. And the spate of police-involved killings that have made headlines and been so controversial, and people know the names of the victims, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Philando Castile, I could go on.
Yes.
To many people, it represents systemic police violence that sees, or bias, I should say, police bias, that sees dark-skinned people as more of a threat than they really are. So how do you put the 1-2% comment in context of what you called police culture and this perception of a systemic bias that allows so many incidents to take place?
I guess I have this different aspect on this. I've been black a long time, so I'm blue. All of my adult life, I've been a police officer. So I've had to talk to widows who, husbands and other spouses whose daughters and sons gave the ultimate sacrifice to protect people. And I've seen officers, white officers, go into their pockets and help families of color when they didn't have to. I've seen such brave and courageous behavior of officers, and I'm finding it difficult to make the contrast with what you see in a viral video and what you never see. Officers, you know, recently here in the Dallas area bought a World War II veteran an air conditioning unit when they saw that he was sitting on his porch outside. And you just don't have balanced coverage of the heroism, bravery, courage, professionalism, while you have, you know, hyper-vigilant, super coverage of viral videos, and that shapes our narratives. Because I see them in balance, and I'm black, and I grew up poor, I find that I have a different perspective. I have a more balanced perspective, but I do understand one life is one too many when it's taken by a cop who shouldn't have taken that action. I completely understand the mistrust, but I just want to reconcile it with your viewers and people here listening that there are some brave people who protect people of color with their lives. That I know personally.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't excuse any of it. I just have this balanced view of, I know that 1 or 2% is not the entirety of the profession.
Dorian in Harlem, you're on WNYC with former Dallas Police Chief David Brown. Hi, Dorian.
Hi, Brian. Nice to talk to you. Chief, I wanted to ask, why, when you and so many other people and police chief and other positions like yours talk about sensible gun regulation, you referred to the mental illness issue, why do you think it's not getting political traction?
Well, one of the things is that we have representative government. And so it's more a reflection of us than it is of the politicians that we're so frustrated with not getting anything done. And it's local. The local democracy is much more powerful than going upstream to the federal. So we just recently had an election here in Dallas, a local election. It's not dissimilar to local elections all across the country. 6% turnout. So our democracy is based on our participating. It's the history of our country. Significant change just has never happened until we engage and participate at the highest levels we possibly can. And you can't expect to be 90%, 94% on the sidelines waiting for the 6% to vote for representative government of our views. It's similar everywhere. There's 10% turnout for a local election, and everything's local. The county, city, that's who hires the police chief, that votes the DAs in, who selects the grand jury presentations and how they're presented to indict and how the reform happens. That's all city, county. And if we vote at the lowest levels for city, county, state, and then we try to, you know, vote at high levels for president, I think we're conflating the wrong. It's inverted on what we should be doing and expecting as far as significant change is concerned. It's about us, not about them. And when it comes to the significant change we all know needs to happen in the way of criminal justice reform.
Mm. And so on the issue of guns, which was part of the caller's question, one congressman who was present at that shooting yesterday said if the incident had happened in his home state of Georgia, it would have ended more quickly because his aides are routinely armed. In Virginia, they weren't allowed to be. And that raises the question of whether a universally armed society leads to more shootings or fewer by prevention. Do you have an opinion?
Yes. We don't have research. All I have is an opinion. And I have July 7th last summer when our five officers were killed. There were people in Texas, you can open carry, had AR-15 slung in the protest. They had vests and gas masks and fatigues, and they were in the protest, marching in the protest. Concerned us, but it's legal, so they were protesting, about 20, 30 people. When the shots rang out, they ran and away from the bullets. Our cops ran toward the bullets. And the argument is a good guy with a gun and more good guys with guns will make us safer when the bad guy with the guns use it. I just hadn't seen that ever play out in reality. Police officers do something that none of us want to do. None of us want to run toward bullets and give our lives for somebody else. Police officers are sworn to do it. I just haven't seen that make us safer. But we don't have the research because we don't fund research for gun violence in this country. I mean, we just don't see that as something important to us, and it's representative government, so it speaks to us about us more than it does with the frustration we have with our politicians. They are elected by us. They represent our views, supposedly.
We have under a minute left, but I want to get a media thought from you. I see you're currently an ABC contributor now, and one of the reasons you say you took that position is because you don't like how the media has covered matters of policing. Give me some tips. What can we do better as an institution?
Find the bravery and courage. If it bleeds, it leads is not always the best ways to get ratings. People love to see bravery and courage on display. And there are many examples of that. Find it and put it in a video loop like we do with the bad shootings that we see.
And we certainly acknowledge the bravery of those Capitol Police officers yesterday, right? Wounded,
yes.
Pursuing the one who was wounded, continued to pursue the shooter even after he was wounded.
Yeah, video loop it, play it over and over again. You'll shape perceptions with it.
Chief David Brown, his new book, Called to Rise, A Life in Faithful Service to the Community That Made Me. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Monday is Loving Day, And I think we could all use a little of that. But Loving Day marks the anniversary of the United States Supreme Court decision in Loving versus Virginia that declared all laws banning interracial marriage unconstitutional. Richard Loving, who was white, and Mildred Loving, who was black and Native American, were married in 1958 in Washington, D.C. But when they returned to their home state of Virginia, they were arrested under that state's law, which criminalized interracial marriage, if you didn't know the history. At their peak, at least 41 states had similar laws designed to preserve white supremacy. By the time the Lovings were married, 16 states still had these laws on the books, 1958, making interracial love and marriage a crime until the Supreme Court declared such laws unconstitutional. You know Jamie Floyd, attorney, legal analyst here at WNYC and the local host of All Things Considered for the station. She was born and raised here in New York, has a personal connection to this story, and she joins us now to talk about the 50th anniversary of the Loving decision and a new project that she's launching on Monday here on the station on love, race, and identity in Trump's America. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Brian. And you know, I think I wrote that part of that introduction, and I'm going to correct myself.
Okay.
And this is a mistake that's often made about the Loving decision.
Uh-huh.
So when the Lovings were married in 58, 2 years after my parents were married in 56, there were 22 laws on the books. By the time the case came down, there were 16. And in fact, when the court took the case, this is how quickly the country was changing, Bob Dylan, changing. There were 17 laws on the books when the court took the case at the beginning of 67. One of those laws was repealed in the course of that year. And by the time the case came down, 16 laws still on the books. But you are so right, 41, at least 41, by some historians count 42 of these laws on the books at the peak of their existence. Virginia's was one of the most insidious, if not the most insidious. It was called the Racial Integrity Act of 1924. And actually, the first one was passed in the 1600s. They were then repealed and then reinstated after the Revolutionary War.
And do you want to reveal your personal connection?
Sure.
To
my parents were married in 1956, and it was at a time when 22 states had these laws. They had to travel to three different states to find a doctor who would give them the blood tests. States had different ways of enforcing the laws, and the laws varied from state to state. And by the way, although the South was the most draconian, and those 16 states that the Lovings confronted were all in the South, it was a majority of Southern states by the year 1958, let's not leave out California. Let's not leave out Arizona. Let's not leave out Texas, my mother's home state, which was one of the states enforcing these laws when my parents were married. My mother was from Texas. My father was from Indiana, which was the cradle of the Klan in the Jim Crow South. A lot of people don't know that. So they were married in 1956 and faced horrific discrimination even after they were able to find a doctor courageous enough to give them the blood test in Chicago. And they got the blood test and they were married. And they stayed married for nearly 60 years until my father's death in 2015.
Who was white? Who was black?
Now, very different from the Lovings, and that's a really significant question, Brian. My father was African American and part Native American. My mother was white. And their love story is I think a truly hopeful sign for what America can be, but I don't think the Lovings would have prevailed had not Richard Loving been white, and many historians of race point that factor out. The Lovings were humble people. They were poor people. They grew up in a part of the South. They were childhood sweethearts and grew up in a part of the South, a rural hamlet of Virginia, where race mixing was common going back to colonial Virginia. So this was nothing unusual to them. They really just wanted to live their lives. They weren't marching on Washington, even though lots of other people were. They weren't terribly well-educated people. But they sensed that this was just wrong. They weren't seeking to change the world or the laws, but
just
in fact, they did.
Marriage and their family and their life.
They had the perfect surname.
Absolutely. Right. God, you know, that's why they chose Sally Ride to be the first woman in space.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, you could think of a million other examples. Did you suggest a minute ago that it was politically easier to get this through the Supreme Court if the man in the couple was white?
I'm not suggesting it. I am stating it. It is, and I believe still is, was and still is, easier for a white man to be in a relationship with a black woman than it is for a black man to be in a relationship with a white woman. And when we talk about interracial love, cohabitation, sex, procreation, the relationship between the black man and the white woman is the relationship feared most by white supremacy. And the Racial Integrity Act, let's be clear, that was rooted in white supremacy. It had as its purpose white supremacy. And of course, first and foremost, it forbade the marriage of any white person with someone of another race. It defined white person as someone who, quote, has no race whatsoever of any blood other than Caucasian. And as you pointed out, Brian, in the intro, you can't go to another state and then come back to Virginia and have a valid marriage.
Yeah.
And these people were lying in the bed, in the privacy of their own home, in the middle of the night, newlyweds, and the cops came storming in and arrested them and threw them into jail, and they were charged. These were felonies in most states, and in Virginia, certainly. So completely violative of the marital home, as the court pointed out in Loving versus Virginia, the right, fundamental right to marry. But I think, as a political matter, the fact that Richard Loving was a white man, a humble family, this was a humble family, that these were poor people, and that they just wanted to get on with living their lives, that made this much more palatable to the court and to the American public.
So, listeners, that's one stream of calls we could take with Jamie Floyd today. If you're part of an interracial couple, do you think you've had a different experience if, you know, the male is white and the female is black, or the other way around? Have you compared notes with other people who are the other way? 212-433-WNYC, personal experiences on that. 212-433-9692. And Jamie, your project that you're launching on Monday, Love, Race, and Identity in Trump's America, is really focused on the children of interracial couples, right?
Yes. I mean, we want to keep the conversation going. It's called the Other Box Project. It's a year-long exploration about what it's meant over the course of these 50 years to check that other box. So we think of the U.S. Census first and foremost, but it's not just there. It's in healthcare. When you go to the doctor and you ask your race, are you black? Are you white? Are you Native American? What we used to call American Indian, and many still do. Are you Hispanic, which is not a race? The census tells you right up front, Hispanic, not a race, but we still want to know, are you that?
Mm-hmm. Other.
Or other. We check the other box. So what does that mean in a society that has failed to fully reckon with multiracial identity? What does it mean to have racial classifications at all? Even though there are some good reasons to have them, why do we have them? And what does it mean for those of us who check more than one box? And by the way, Brian, you could only start checking more than one box on the census in the year 2000. That's a new thing. And it's the fastest growing category in American life on the census.
More than one, check all that apply.
Check all that apply.
Rather than being lumped into other if no simple category works for you.
Exactly.
Do you like it?
Do I like it? I, if people really care about me, because this project is not about me. I'm interested as a journalist, as a reporter, as the curator of this project in hearing other people's stories. But for me, I'm African American. And one of the things we've learned in this, in the run-up to this project, we started in 2014, is that it's very much a continuum of time. So if you go back to people like myself, and people are surprised when I say I'm African American. You can go on the WNYC website right now and look at my picture, and you might say, really? But I'm African American. I was born in 1964. Civil Rights Act passed that year, 65, the Voting Rights Act. Loving was 3 years. I wasn't legitimate in 16 states,
yeah.
Right? So those of us, Barack Obama, white mother, raised by his white grandparents, but considers himself, has said very boldly and plainly, African American. But when you get to people born in the 70s, certainly in the 80s, and you come to the 90s and people born after the year 2000, definitions of ourselves start to change. And the reason for that, Brian, is that we didn't even have the language when I was growing up. We didn't have multiracial and biracial. We were struggling for language. Colored was a term applied to us. We didn't like it. Mixed race, okay, that kind of worked. Mulatto? No, right, no. I was called things like half-breed, mixed nigger, half-nigger. I know this is WMYC, but I know also the list of words that we have to cut for, and this isn't one of them. I was called Oreo cookie. That was a kinder word that was used for me. This was in New York City, Brian, here in Greenwich Village and on the Lower East Side. So you can imagine what was happening to kids in Virginia who were mixed race, or in Alabama or Mississippi, the places where the Racial Integrity Act, that held on in Virginia till 1979. So to find your identity, it was much easier for people born in 54, 64, even 74, to just embrace African-American identity, what we then called black, or black power even.
So in framing the Other Box Project as love, race, and identity in Trump's America, are you looking for people in this other category, this mixed race category, to play a certain role in our divided nation?
Yes. Well, what I found in watching my parents and their 60-year love story was their ability to share with me a conversation between each other and across racial lines. And so what I've seen, especially across generations, so our project has people from ages 90 all the way down to 14 years old. And the ability of those people who grew up in families like mine to have conversations with people of all races and also all generations about race, but also class, gender identity, identity broadly speaking, in this really divisive time, I think is phenomenal. And Brian, I conceived this project when Barack Obama was still president, and I thought, wow, we have this biracial, multiracial family, this the first, I mean, he we think of him as a black president, but he is really from a biracial family. So that was what we originally conceived the project to be as he was getting ready to leave office. But now with President Trump in office and a resurgence of neo-nationalism, I think it's critically important to have these conversations. And the people I've met in the run-up to this project, Gina Belafonte will be with us in the green space, Harry Belafonte's daughter, on Monday, as will Ali Ben-Ami, who's an activist student at Amherst. He's a quarter Venezuelan, a quarter African-American, a quarter Puerto Rican. I mean, he's done his Dr. Henry Gates, Henry Louis Gates homework, but
he got his genealogy test and learned that he's from all those different
backgrounds. And unlike me, he doesn't think in terms of race. He thinks in terms of activism, in terms of community, in terms of engagement with people across. He doesn't talk in terms of identity in the same way someone born in 1964 does. And I have learned so much from this kid. So that's what we want to do.
Tracy in Summit, you're on WNYC with Jamie Floyd. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Tracy.
I'm just calling, because I was born in 57. My parents were married in 56. My father was black. My mother is from Europe. And they were married in New York City, I believe. They came over here, and they got married in New York City, and they had a fairly quiet life. People let them live their lives in peace. Interestingly enough, in the last 5 years, when they were elderly, they were driving up from Washington, D.C., stopped at a motel in Virginia to spend the night, and they were harassed there, and they were threatened. Somebody
in Virginia?
Called their hotel room and threatened them and told them to get out. And, you know, us kids were absolutely devastated by that because we had never experienced that kind of racism towards our parents. And here they were, two older people just trying to spend the night in a hotel, and the people in this that owned the hotel didn't like it and let them know. And so they got up and they got dressed in the middle of the night, and they sat up all night waiting for the sun to come up. because they were afraid that if they tried to flee in the middle of the night, that somebody would attack them. And so that's what they did. And they got, when the sun came up, they got in the car and they drove back to New York where they were safe. Mm. And this was in the last 5 years.
Tracy, this happened in Virginia, the same state as the Lovings came from.
They took the train. They used to winter in Florida, and they took the train to either Washington or somewhere around there, and then they got held up, and so they wanted to spend the night and then get back on the road early the next morning, and it was a very dangerous thing for them to do. We were heartbroken that in this country that something like that would happen, and my parents were the nicest. My mother's still alive. I just lost my father. But we were heartbroken that that would happen to them, such decent people who had really lived in peace. I grew up on Staten Island, but had lived in peace all of their lives. There was a few odd incidents, but that it should happen so recently, and it so terrified them.
What a dramatic piece of oral history. Mm-hmm. Tracy, thank you very much for sharing it.
And those kinds of stories are the kinds of stories we want to gather. We're going to put our talk box, it looks like an old phone booth, but we use it to gather stories. We're going to have it in the green space on Monday night. Maybe Tracy will join us there on Monday night in the green space. And we want those stories because we want to move the country forward with the Other Box Project. That's a very sad story. When she says heartbroken, it does pain me. But the fact that her parents were able to live for so many decades as an interracial couple with so few incidents is a hopeful sign, I think, Brian. It's deeply saddening that they had that incident so late in life. But for the most part, it sounds as though they had a happy life together as an interracial couple with few incidents.
We'll take more of your calls in a minute. Brian Lehrer with Jamie Floyd on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with our All Things Considered host and sometimes legal analyst, Jamie Floyd, who's launching a new project on the station on Monday called The Other Box Project, Love, Race, and Identity in Trump's America, for the 50th anniversary, which is Monday, of the Supreme Court's Loving versus Virginia decision that declared all laws banning interracial marriage unconstitutional. There were still 16 states at that time that banned interracial marriage. Seems such a short time ago in that context, 50 years ago, that was still illegal in 16 states in the United States of America. Incredible. And Anthony in Bronxville, you're on WNYC with Jamie. Hi, Anthony.
Yeah, hi, Brian. Good morning. I have a son who's 40, and he's married to an Italian girl. I have four beautiful mixed grandchildren. But when I was, I'm 62, when I was young and we went to Florida and we were denied service in South Carolina, I went to see the Dirty Dozen in a movie in Florida and was told to go sit up in the back. So for my son to be married to a white girl and her family, who was beautiful still, her aunt, the whole thing, you know, it gives me hope for our country, because I can't see anything wrong in that at all, as long as two people love each other. And you see the kids are beautiful. I think this is God what made us to be, you know, not one or the other, but mixed.
That's exactly what this project is about, and that kind of call and that kind of sentiment. Unfortunately, we're not all there yet, Anthony, but we hope that we can carry the message that you just brought to this show, to Brian's show, across the country. And thank you so much for sharing that and having the grandchildren. It's about the grandchildren, right? It's about the grandchildren.
Oh, my God, they're beautiful.
Anthony, thank you very much. See, there's the universal.
Right.
My grandchildren are beautiful.
Right. The problem is, though, Brian, as we found out with the election, we here in New York and out in California, the coasts, and I mean city, New York City, we forget that not everybody feels that way.
Michelle in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you both for having this very important conversation. So I'm Asian American. I'm originally from Los Angeles, and my husband is Caucasian American, originally from Central Connecticut. And we have two beautiful, multiracial babies. And I just wanted to share that ever since the election, I've been very hesitant about going out in public when we are back in my husband's hometown in Central Connecticut, because it was a majority of the voters there did vote for Trump, which to me kind of attests to a maybe underlying sort of racial bias. The way the political climate is now, I do feel very geographically bound in terms of like keeping my children safe to major cities like Los Angeles and New York and maybe Chicago. Whereas before we used to talk about, you know, going on road trips to the South, through cross country, but now, and especially after hearing that other caller describing the horrible experience her parents went through in Virginia, I just, I'm very fearful
and
about.
Are you, Michelle, if I may ask, East Asian?
Yes, I am.
So even for you, who might not be identified by some random person as, oh, that's a Muslim or an Arab or something like that, misidentified as some people who are not those things are misidentified, you don't have that particular fear. But even with you, as an East Asian married to a white person and with your kids, you feel something is different in Trump's America.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is a racial hierarchy existing in this country and in many other places around the world, for sure, even in East Asia. And I think it's a misnomer to say that East Asians are sort of immune to being the target of, racial discrimination.
They're just not what's on the tip of Trump's tongue is the only reason I'm asking.
And it's I think there's been several instances of like hate crimes targeted towards East Asian communities. You know, it's just like open the Pandora's box of hate.
There is and there always has been a hierarchy, a racial hierarchy, a supremacy, a white supremacy in this country, and as you say, elsewhere. But I think that families like yours and like mine are the answer to that, to deconstructing that. And the courage that you have had and that you must continue to have to step out, to step into those communities where that hierarchy is strong. And to give you that courage, let me point out that 17% of new marriages and 20% of cohabitating relationships are interracial or interethnic. 24% of adopted children in the U.S. are placed with a parent of a race different from their own. So lots of people are touched by these relationships or affected by these relationships, and many of those people are Trump supporters. And we've done stories here at WMYC. My colleagues Matt Katz and Arun Venugopal have talked to Trump supporters with black children, with children of color, with grandchildren of color. So they're out there, and there may be a disconnect between their families and their vote, but we can reach those people. And please have the courage to do so.
Michelle, thank you for calling in. Jamie, did you want to say something about the newer category of people who are allowed to get married and how it intersects with this now 50-year-old category of people who the Supreme Court officially allowed to get married? So interracial gay couples?
Yes. So we were together, of course, on the day that Obergefell came down.
You were on the air with me.
Yes.
You had one of those unforgettable days.
Yes. And so the precedent that the court relied upon for that case, it wasn't firmly rooted in Loving, though, of course, they did cite Loving. They cited a lot of other cases more strongly. But I believe the cultural precedent was very strong. When you think about how far we have come, you know, as Dr. King said, the arc of the
history bends toward justice.
Moral universe, bends toward justice.
However slowly.
There are days in which I think, really, Dr. King, are you looking? Is it bending? Are we getting toward justice? There are those days. But generally, I think he is correct, because if you think about how far we've come since Loving on multicultural society, when you look around at the number of interracial couples, and as I just quoted those statistics. And then you see the gay marriage decision. I think the precedent there was not so much in law, but it was in culture that opened the hearts of the justices. The hearts, I say, not the legal intellect, the hearts of the justices to do the right thing, in the words of Spike Lee. And then when you talk about interracial gay couples, I mean, that, you know, that is a challenging place to be in America. But they can be now. They can be legally under the law now. And to come that far in 50 years really says something about our constitutional democracy as intended by the founders, who truly never thought about interracial marriage. No, because we know black people were not people in the eyes of our founders or gay marriage. But the document itself allows for this. That's the purpose of our Constitution, to protect the oppressed, not the majority.
Loving Day in Pride Month. Esther in Highland Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Esther.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm really loving this conversation. I really am.
Loving it.
I just, as a mother of biracial kids, I just wanted to put a point out there, and as somebody who studies race relations, I just want to be careful about us not fetishizing the idea of mixed race status. And the only reason I'm saying this is increasingly in our media, we do see this where mixed race is kind of setting in as a preference over blackness.
Absolutely.
And the only reason I'm saying this is because in other cultures where we have large mixed race populations, a hierarchy does tend to form where you have whiteness at the top and variations of mixed race categories filling in the spaces in between. And then the black communities end up suffering even more, whether it's just being relegated as being somehow not cooperative in this process of wanting to fold into mixed race status, or, you know, just even more marginalization. And that's pretty much the point I wanted to make.
Absolutely. And as I said earlier, I don't know if you were listening, I define myself as African-American, even though my mother is white, and my father, though black, I'm sure his ancestry includes whiteness, because most African-Americans who were on slave plantations suffered some rape at the hands of the slave master. I want to mention two people part of the project. Fanshan Cox DiGiovanni, who has the One Drop of Love project, talks about something called white adjacency. And that's the benefit that multiracial people enjoy by being part white in a society in which whiteness is preferred, because this is still a white supremacist society. So I completely agree with you. And the goal of this project, you know, if we were to look ahead 100 years, and let's say the Other Box Project is not a 1-year project, but it's a 100-year project, there would be no race, because race is a construct. And so we wouldn't have white people at the top of the race pyramid and black people at the very bottom, where we still are. Let's just put it out there, you know, with the possible exception of what's happened to Muslim people in the wake of 9/11 and the obsessive concern about ISIS. Black people, look at the prisons. Look at Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. Well, it's the same old Jim Crow that we're still living with. So I am completely with you. This is not about any sort of fetishizing, media depictions, all of that business. This is about deconstructing race. And Walter Mosley speaks and writes beautifully about how there is no white race. There's no white. There's no the race, Asian, black. This is crazy. It's craziness. It's white craziness. It's what Studs Terkel called the American obsession. And we need to get over it. But the reason we're doing the Other Box Project is because we cannot get over it until we talk about it honestly. And we have never in this country had that conversation about race that we've always said we were going to have. I mean, all due respect to Barack Obama, a couple of beers on the lawn of the White House with Dr. Gates and a cop, that is not the conversation about race we need to be having in this country. We're hoping to start that conversation on Monday with this project.
Esther, any quick thought?
I mean, there's a lot that can be said here, because like she said, it's such a big topic as far as breaking it down. And I am thankful for like the Otherness project that you guys are doing, just trying to categorize and break this down. And I do look forward to hearing the conversations as they proceed.
Thank you very much for your call. And as we run out of time, again, listeners, this starts in earnest on the station on Monday. Jamie Floyd's project called The Other Box. You're saying The Other Box. I'll call it The Other Box because it's about checking the other box on the census. Love, race, and identity in Trump's America. How can people find out more?
We have a website for that. It's otherboxproject.org, otherboxproject.org. And if you want tickets, we have an event Monday night at 7 o'clock in the green space here at WNYC. Doors will open at 6:30. The tickets are available at thegreenspace.org. And this is public radio, people, so really the tickets are really super value, as they say. Super value tickets, really just what we need to cover our costs. So we hope you'll join us Monday night in the green space. Tracy, Esther, Anthony, all our great callers, come on down and say some more.
Remember the names of all the callers. I'm impressed. And another easy way to find your way to that event is just wnyc.org/thegreenspace.
Yes.
Jamie, congrats. I'll be listening.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. The so-called summer of hell for Penn Station commuters is about to descend upon us. July 10th, to be precise, is when Amtrak's track work at Penn and the commuting pain will start, and it'll last until September 1st. The Long Island Railroad and New Jersey Transit have each released more details now about how they'll handle it, and the MTA has even recommended businesses simply let employees work from home to try to lessen the travel chaos. Here with me now to tell us about these plans and answer your questions are Danielle Ferfaro, a transit reporter for the New York Post, and Larry Higgs, commuting reporter for NJ Advance Media for NJ.com. Hi, Danielle. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And hi, Larry. Welcome back.
Hi. How are you? Good to be back.
And listeners, if you commute through Penn Station, have you figured out what you plan to do yet this summer during the track work? You can give us a call at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Will you try to take a ferry or a bus instead of the train? Have you talked to your boss? Will they let you actually stay home, work from home, adjust your hours as the MTA has suggested that people try to do? Or if you're a Penn Station commuter and you just have a question for my guests about how the track work at Penn Station and how it'll affect your commute is going to go, give us a call now at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. There's also Governor Cuomo getting some flack for trying to focus on drivers during this period rather than mass transit commuters, but you can call about any of it with a comment or a question. And Larry, let's start with you. Last week, New Jersey Transit released the dreaded schedule changes for the summer. What are the main headlines?
Well, the main headlines are 75% of the trains that NJ Transit runs during the rush hour will still go to Penn Station. That's kind of their big takeaway, that they're holding three-quarters of their customers harmless. The big problem is the remaining 25% are concentrated on one line, and that's the Morris and Essex lines, because that line naturally goes to Hoboken. You've got some pushback from riders on that line because they're wondering why they've been singled out. You had a group of mayors from towns on the Morris and Essex lines that met with NJ Transit because they felt that, number one, they should have been included in the process, and they had some specific questions that they wanted asked. They wanted to know if the path would cross Honor all over its system instead of at the major terminals. They wanted to know if there were going to be consumer representatives out there at the station platforms to give people an idea of what was happening. And there was a little bit of political drama there because the mayors had scheduled a meeting on May 30th and had been changed twice. They were pushed off to June 6th. And they were a little angry about that because they felt that that would be too late for them to make any changes if NJ Transit officials decided that one of the mayors had an idea they wanted to implement.
So
that's kind of the backstory here.
So commuters on the Morris and Essex line are the most affected. Almost all of those weekday trains that usually go into Penn Station will terminate at Hoboken. But I gather the Morris Essex line is the second busiest in the system. So do you know why NJT would choose that line to mess with the most?
Well, it goes back to history. The NJ Transit is basically a system of predecessor railroads that really didn't connect with one another. The Morris and Essex line was built by the Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western Railroad, and it went to Hoboken because they weren't as well-heeled as the Pennsylvania Railroad to build tunnels directly into the city. So traditionally, riders on that line, on the old Jersey Central and on the old Erie lines, their commute stopped at the Hudson, and they either took ferries or later on when it came into existence, the Hudson Manhattan Railroad, which became the path.
Daniel.
So NJ Transit's looking at it as this is just a natural, it's an organic way to do this. They built a connection in 1996 that allowed Morris and Essex trains to get on the Northeast Corridor and go to Penn Station. The problem is NJ Transit says that connection doesn't really work well in advance. So it would be a severe bottleneck to take Northeast Corridor line trains and send them to Hoboken on that little connection. Mm-hmm.
Danielle, give us the headlines for Long Island Railroad commuters. I think in sum total, it looks like their plight is possibly even worse than New Jersey commuters.
There's going to be about 20% of those trains in both the morning and evening commute that won't go into Penn Station that normally would. Some of them are going to be canceled, but a lot of them will be rerouted to places like Hunter's Point and Jamaica and Atlantic Terminal. So riders will then have to they're going to set up a ferry system. They're going to try to run ferries from Glen Cove and also from Long Island City. So commuters are going to have to take a variety of things. So maybe they'll take a train to Jamaica and then take some buses that will run into Midtown, or there's going to be some park and rides, or they can get on a ferry. It's definitely going to lengthen everyone's commutes in both directions.
15 fewer direct trains to Penn Station in the morning, 17 fewer trains leaving in the evenings. Though we should point out that the LIRR is also adding a few new rush hour trains to Penn for this period and lengthening some trains. Do you know any more about which lines those will affect?
Those will be on the Babylon line, and it'll vary according to the days, but it should affect about 9,600 riders in total. The total changes that they're going to make. That's how many people will be affected. They're also canceling three overnight lines that'll affect about 90 commuters total, and they don't have any other ways for them to get in. Those be the overnight lines.
Some of these alternatives are more complex than the New Jersey changes. So let's go through these a little bit more in detail. What you were mentioning, a new ferry will run from Glen Cove to 34th Street.
Mm-hmm. And a ferry from Long Island City to 34th Street.
Okay. Yes. How long does it take by ferry? Do you know, to get from Glen Cove to 34th Street?
Well, they still haven't really worked it out, and of course then they're subject to the maritime rules and the wake rules and everything like that. Mm. So I don't know if there's an exact time on it, but definitely those ferries go a lot slower, as we've seen with the new citywide ferry service. They have to like I said, they have to account for a lot of different rules out there.
And park and ride bus stops at Roosevelt Field Mall, North Hempstead Beach Park, that's Port Washington, Belmont Racetrack, Valley Stream, Nassau Coliseum, Bethpage State Park, Seaford, where the railroad station is, Melville Park and Ride. What does that mean? Is that going to be something other than trains? Is that buses from
there? Those will be buses. Those will be buses that will come into Midtown, and they will have stops that will go across 34th Street and 42nd Street. So people will stop at various points, from the east to the west. So they're trying. They're trying as hard as they can with a really lousy hand that they've been dealt.
Why Glen Cove in particular, and only Glen Cove, if I understand it correctly, for ferry service? What about other points along the North Shore? What about other points on the South Shore?
I'm really not sure. I don't know if that was they really could only afford to get two ferries, and that was just the point that they chose. They've said that they really don't know where the money is coming from for this at this point.
Let's take some phone calls as we have our New York, New Jersey Summer from Hell Transit Summit with our New York and New Jersey guests, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. For Larry Higgs, commuting reporter for NJ.com, and Danielle Forfaro, transit reporter for the New York Post. And Jared in Kips Bay, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jared.
Hey, Brian. I've actually called in before on this issue, but was just telling your call receiver, I grew up in Morristown, took the train to the city for a few years, now live in the city, but I still feel the pain when I have to go back and visit my parents. My one question was, I saw that they're cutting prices on the Morris Essex line to kind of make up for the loss of service for commuters. New Jersey has to, I think, fill a gap of $15 million in lost revenue. My question is Amtrak footing that bill, or is that New Jersey taxpayers? Because it seems a bit unfair given it's Amtrak's repairs.
Larry, do you know?
Well, nothing's been said about that as far as who's picking up the bill or how much it's going to cost, because there is a lot of cost associated with this. NJ Transit is going to have to pick up the bill for cross-honoring people when they get on the PATH system. They're going to have to pick up the bill for cross-honoring when they get on New York Waterway Ferries. And New York Waterway Ferry is a private company, so they're unsubsidized. We're still waiting for some numbers from NJ Transit to see how much it costs them when they cross-honor during the week in April, after the April 3rd derailment. But it's a price. And the problem is you're dealing with Amtrak, which is they don't exactly have robust finances, which is why they're in this problem in the first place as far as Penn Station infrastructure goes. There is a discount, though. You are correct. But that is being extended to Morris and Essex Line commuters who buy tickets to Hoboken. And that's being stressed by NJ Transit. They have an entire page on their website called the plan update, and it lays it out as far as what the schedules are and exactly what you can and cannot do as far as cross-honoring goes.
And Danielle, what about Amtrak's own schedule changes? Is it known how many trains a day they're going to cancel into Penn Station?
They are, yeah. They're changing a lot of their service. The Northeast schedule, the Northeast line will go through D.C. and the Crescent line is only going to D.C. and that won't come to New York City anymore. They are going to make a lot of changes. But the issue is that the Amtrak trains, even though Amtrak owns Penn Station and owns the tracks, only 10% of those trains that go through there are Amtrak trains. Most of them are Long Island Railroad and New Jersey Transit.
So, Larry, was there some kind of negotiation between Amtrak and the local commuter lines, NJT and LIRR, as to who would bear how much of the burden of, I guess, three track closings at a time?
Well, they negotiated as far as the plan that resulted from both the one that the LIRR announced this week and the plan that NJ Transit announced last week. But the bottom line is Amtrak is saying we're closing a certain amount of tracks during this period of time, and these are your options. You know, Wick Moreland, the president of Amtrak, said before anything was announced that he expected that 25% of the service would be curtailed, and that's exactly what materialized out of NJ Transit. Mm.
Jennifer in Berkeley Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm just confused and concerned, and I'm hoping maybe I can get some advice on how this is going to work this summer. My daughter, who is 17, is attending a 2-week program that, of course, lands during this construction time. And our plan was for her to take the train independently from New Jersey, which she'll originate in Summit into Penn Station. The first couple times, probably I would go with her, but then she was excited about being able to do this herself. So now my understanding is she'll only be able to get as far as Hoboken. Is that accurate?
It depends on what time of day. Rush hour train. I took a look at the schedule this morning, in fact, the summer schedule. Rush hour trains are going to go to Hoboken. There will be 4 trains that will go to Penn Station. But basically, those are very early morning trains, and they have to get into Penn Station before 7 o'clock. 7 o'clock in the morning. 7 o'clock in the morning is the witching hour. After that, everything gets diverted to Hoboken, except for Montclair Bouton Line trains, because there are only a few of those. Those will continue to go to New York. Everything else on the M&E will go to Hoboken. Now, at Hoboken, she has the option of either being able to change to a PATH train for free or to a ferry for free. They are going to run a new ferry line that had run in April during the problems, and that's going to go to the West 39th Street ferry terminal in Midtown. And from there, NY Waterway has buses that will take you to various destinations in Midtown. So it's going to depend on where she's going.
Okay.
Jennifer.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So, and then to get home, are there trains that do originate in Penn Station back to Summit Station, like not on the rush hour time?
Outside of the rush hour, after the rush hour, there is. And you can see that you can check those times. She can check those times at njtransit.com. They have and just click on the update. It's right in the middle of the website. And then you can get a link that'll take you right to the schedule. So she can see what her options are. So there will be some options after the rush hour to take a train directly out of Penn Station.
Jennifer, thanks for your call. Good luck to you and your daughter this summer as we talk about the changes for commuters from Long Island and New Jersey who usually go through Penn Station between July 10th and September 1st coming this summer for Amtrak repair and construction work with our guest Larry Higgs, commuting reporter for NJ.com, and Danielle Ferfaro, transit reporter for the New York Post, the New York-New Jersey Summit on the commuting summer from hell. And Danielle, I also see that the MTA is planning to speed up construction on bridges and tunnels and offer trucks discounted tolls overnight to try to encourage driving then instead of during the day, I guess to clear up more space on the road for car commuters.
Right.
Who are going to, you know, for people who are deciding to drive rather than take these mass transit workarounds. Do you think a lot of Long Islanders will just drive into the city who usually don't?
Honestly, I hope not, because congestion in the city is at an all-time peak already. So I think that's the fear, is that people decided to drive in, but it would, you know, it would take at this point a few hours to drive in from Long Island with the amount of congestion that there is. So I think that will be some people's instinct, but that probably won't be the best way to get into the city.
And on that point, I'm seeing some outrage that Governor Cuomo directed the MTA to speed up fixing bridges and tunnels. I guess it looks like they're bending over backwards to accommodate drivers and not mass transit commuters. I saw one pointed tweet at the governor that just read, "Fix the subway, idiot." And someone tweeted at us this morning that it's, quote, astounding that the governor sees accommodating drivers as the way to mitigate the travel hell this summer. What do you make of all that?
Well, there's long been a lot of tension between the ridership and Cuomo, because Cuomo, you know, the state funds the majority of the MTA, but the state isn't very quick to give that money over. So the MTA is constantly scrambling to do its capital construction plans. And there's, you know, just like with Penn Station, a lot of the infrastructure in the subways is very old and very in need of repair. The signals, the tracks, there's constant delays. So, you know, you're asking the Long Island Railroad customers in some cases to get on, to get on the 7 train from Hunter's Point and, you know, get on the F train from Jamaica, things like that. But those, those lines and those services are already at mass peak ridership anyway, and they can't really handle that much more.
I see that calling in is the mayor of Maplewood, Victor DeLuca. Mr. Mayor, thank you for calling. You're on WNYC.
Thank you very much. I wanted to just thank Larry. I think he did a great report of our difficulties with transit. The transit is picking our lines, the M&E lines, 23,000 people a day. They had no conversations with us beforehand. It was quite a shock when we heard the governor say that we were not going to get any trains. We were able to get 4 trains in the morning, but still it's just a very unfair system and decision-making. Our commuters are confused. I think if that is the word, there's just confusion out there. There's really been a lack of rollout by the New Jersey Transit. You know, they've set up the website. We've asked them to station people in our terminals and our train stations now. We haven't heard if they're going to do that. But people need answers now so that they can plan what they're doing. And I still think that there's a lack of transparency on the part of transit. And they need to be more forthcoming. So that people are very clear about their plan. We've made some plans this morning. We met We're changing our jitney routes to make sure people can get to those early trains. We're talking about ferrying people over to buses in our neighbor South Orange. But most importantly, we're just trying to get information to folks so that they can make an informed decision.
What more can they do at this point, Mayor?
Well, Transit can add some more buses, express buses. They've only selected four places. We've asked them to put buses, express buses, in our town. They have refused to this point. There are also just ways in which they can work with us. We'd like to set up a system of starting to inform New York employers that this is really going to be difficult for their employees, and if it's possible to get people to work at home. I think it would be great if Governor Christie and Governor Cuomo would do a joint letter letting people know that the best recourse of the best course of action here would be to allow people to work at home as much as possible and not have to go through this ordeal.
The mayor of Maplewood, Victor DeLuca, calling in. Mayor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marcus and Ron Conkema, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marcus.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we're okay.
Well, I just want to say that the planning for this has not been coordinated, and I'll give you two very good examples. You know how you change at Jamaica? The route that goes into Atlantic Avenue at the Barclay Center is very, very underutilized. So they could simply curtail some of the trains going into Penn Station and run them into Atlantic Avenue, or to Woodside or to Hunter's Point. The benefit of doing that is that it frees up the tunnels going to Long Island. Most people don't realize that the
going
Jersey
to Penn
Transit
Station.
Trains are stored during the day in Sunnyside, Queens, right near the PS1 MoMA library.
Let me, and we're running out of time, but let me get responses to a few really interesting things that you put on the table there. One, is that true? Are New Jersey Transit trains stored in Sunnyside Yards, Danielle, to your knowledge, not in New Jersey? Not all of them in New Jersey.
The Long Island. You know, I'm really not sure. I know that the Long Island Railroad trains are, and also the Amtrak trains are. There might be a handful of New Jersey.
I've never noticed. I've been through there, and I have family in Sunnyside, and I go through there, and I use the trains, all the various lines there, and I've never noticed New Jersey Transit trains sitting there. But that's interesting if true. And also, I imagine they looked at the various options that he was mentioning for Long Island commuters. One is, and people who don't use the LIRR may not realize, of course, the trains do go, for the most part, to Penn Station, but some of them go to Atlantic Terminal, mm-hmm. In Brooklyn at Atlantic Avenue there near BAM, and they could also go to just as far as Woodside and not go into the city, and people can take the 7 train from there. I imagine they're doing that with as much platform capacity as they have.
Right, because there's platform capacity on the subways too, we got to remember. So if you're coming into Atlantic Terminal, there's all those trains that come in there, but those trains are often packed in the mornings, and the 7 train is always packed pretty much. So if you have when they have people coming in to other sections of the train, when they have them coming into like the end of the F train at Jamaica, for example, there's going to be a lot more room to put those commuters on those subway trains.
So Larry, last thing for you, and then we're going to be out of time. Is there at least light at the end of the Hudson River Tunnel? You reported in May that May was New Jersey Transit's worst performing month ever in terms of on-time trains. So once this track work is done, after the commuter summer from hell, does that mean service will improve?
Well, that's the hope. But the problem is you're dealing with a very, very old infrastructure. And when we talk about infrastructure, we're not just talking about tracks. We're talking about the overhead wires, which is 80 years old in some places. It goes back to the original Pennsylvania Railroad installation in the 1930s. And it's going to take billions of dollars to fix that stuff. So there are going to be delays, but they may be scattered to other places up and down the Northeast Corridor, which, of course, as NJ Transit will point out, is owned by Amtrak, and they're a tenant on that. So part of the problem also is working out a joint benefits program, which has been in effect for a while, where NJ Transit pays Amtrak to make repairs, and they have to agree on what to spend that money on. And that's a point of debate as far as making those payments and then deciding what gets repaired. But it's a very, very big backlog.
And that's our New York, New Jersey Transit Summit for the Summer of Hell, that track work affecting Penn Station to start July 10th and last to September 1st. Larry Higgs, commuting reporter for NJ.com. Danielle Ferfaro, transit reporter for the New York Post. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.